This is Jeff Blankford welcoming you to the July 11th edition of Takes on the World, a program on international affairs. Usually comes your way the second and fourth Wednesday of every month, and every other fifth Wednesday when I open the phones to get your takes on the world. This coming Monday, President Donald Trump and Russia's Vladimir Putin will sit down in a room together in the Finnish capital for their first summit meeting. The fact that they're even holding this meeting seems to trouble Democrats and liberal media even more than Trump's tete-a-tete with North Korea's Kim Jong-un. That led to his canceling of the annual war game staged by U.S. forces and the South Korean military forces close to the partition between the two Koreas, which troubled Republicans as well as Democrats. Now, what will he promise to give away at the hands of the wily Putin, they wonder? Well, it's good for American presidents to meet with adversaries to clarify differences and resolve disputes, the New York Times editorialized. But when President Trump sits down with President Vladimir Putin in Helsinki, he's kindred spirits, and that's a problem, end quote. That Trump said yesterday that meeting with Putin will be easier than the NATO summit that began today in Brussels and runs to tomorrow probably will give critics of the meeting even more concern. The headline of Monday's New York Times leading the way said that Trump will be, quote, wild card among the allies, and argue that in the Trump era, however, that these meetings have become, quote, anxiety-producing confrontations where the main object is to avoid long-term damage to the military alliance. This time, the stakes are even higher, says the Times report, as the allies seek to project strength and solidarity against Russian threats, end quote. And these threats are never spelled out because they really don't exist anymore than they did in the first Cold War is beside the point. What's interesting is the different responses on the part of Democrats to Trump's meeting with Kim Jong-un and Vladimir Putin compared with how positively Democrats of the earlier Cold War generation responded to Richard Nixon's meeting with Mao Zedong in Beijing in 1972. To discuss those differences and their implications, I'll be speaking at 20 minutes past the hour with veteran foreign correspondent and head of Consortium News, Joe Loria. So stay tuned for that. One issue that the mainstream media keeps harping about when it comes to Putin is Russia's annexation of Crimea in 2014. Not once, I repeat, not once have I heard any one of the government experts on NPR or other mainstream news note that this was not out of the blue, but came in response to the U.S.-backed coup in Kiev, which toppled the legally elected president of Ukraine, Viktor Yanukovych. Yanukovych, like every other Ukrainian head of state before and since, was mired in corruption, and his replacement, Petro Poroshenko, has been no different. For the moment, whether or not one accepts that 97% of the Russian-speaking Crimeans voted to once again become part of Russia, it was evident from a geopolitical standpoint that Russia could not afford to give up control of the Crimean port of Sevastopol, where, in arrangement with the Ukraine government, it kept 25,000 troops stationed. Given the virulent anti-Russian feelings of those who pulled off the 2014 coup, it was likely the new pro-Western government in Kiev would cancel the agreement and pressure the Russians to leave. Putin's action preempted that. At the meeting of the G7 in Ottawa, Trump had reportedly rattled a few cages by defending Russia's retaking of Crimea on the basis that the people there speak Russian. Why they do, the media never explains, so I will in brief. From the middle of the 15th century to 1783, Crimea was part of the Ottoman Empire. In that year, under Catherine the Great, Russia defeated the Ottomans, and under the treaty ending the war, Crimea became part of Russia and later the Soviet Union. That was the way things stood until 1954, when Soviet Premier, the Ukrainian-born Nikita Khrushchev, transferred Crimea from the jurisdiction of the Russian Federation to that of the Ukrainian Soviet Socialist Republic, where, following the collapse of the Soviet Union in 1991, it would become an autonomous republic with its own parliament within an independent Ukraine. In the aftermath of the coup, the Crimean parliament, following the overwhelming popular vote, elected to join the Russian Federation. Considering that the legitimate government of Ukraine had been overthrown, it can be argued the Crimeans had every right to do that. The U.S. and its Western allies, of course, have refused to accept that decision or even discuss it, and Russia was then subjected to sanctions. You may recall that Putin and his allies in eastern Ukraine, where there had been no reported anti-government protest, charged at the more militant of the opponents to Yanukovych in Maidan Square with the political descendants of an organization that had allied itself with Nazi Germany in World War II. Of course, this was played down by the U.S. media and ignored by the Obama administration and its point person, Victoria Nuland, his Secretary of State for Europe, and Hillary Clinton's former press spokesperson. Twice I have played a short clip for you from Nuland's pre-coup talk to the Ukrainian-American Association, in which she said that the U.S. had spent $5 billion, that's billion with a B, to change the regime in Ukraine. And you also heard here twice her secretly recorded phone conversation, no doubt by the Russians, with the U.S. ambassador, in which she decided before the coup who would be the next leader of the Ukrainian, of the next Ukrainian prime minister. But we don't hear much about Ukraine anymore, except small stories about the continuing corruption. Monday's Israeli Daily Haaretz, however, had a story on Ukraine you will not likely hear or read about in any mainstream U.S. media. A group of more than 40 Israeli human rights activists have filed a petition with Israel's High Court of Justice demanding the ending of Israeli arms exports to Ukraine. They argue, according to Haaretz, that Israeli weapons have gone to forces that openly espouse a neo-Nazi ideology, and they cite evidence that the right-wing Azov militia, whose members are part of Ukraine's armed forces and supported by the country's Ministry of Internal Affairs, are using these weapons. An earlier response of theirs to the Israel Defense Ministry received no response. The Azov militia was established in Ukraine following the Russian annexation of Crimea in 2014. According to the Haaretz article, its members use the Nazi salute and its uniforms carry swastikas and SS insignias. The militia's founder, Andriy Beletsky, currently a member of Ukraine's parliament, formerly headed a neo-Nazi group called Patriot of Ukraine, now defunct. Its members comprise the founding corps of Azov. Since the spring of 2015, members of the Azov militia have reportedly been part of the regular security forces in Ukraine, the National Guard. While the militia encourages its members to enlist in the National Guard, it maintains itself as a separate organization. Lawyers for the petitioners in Israel have provided the court with ample evidence of Israel's role in arming Ukraine. Ukrainian soldiers, they say, for example, have been seen carrying Israeli-made Tavor rifles in military practices. And a Ukrainian company has signed a contract to produce the Tavor as well as two other Israeli rifles. Elbit Systems, one of Israel's largest military contractors, is to be part of a group investing in Ukraine's military establishment. 4 years ago, Elbit received a $145 million contract from the U.S. Department of Homeland Security to build surveillance towers on the Arizona-Mexico border. In the city of Dnepropetrovsk in eastern Ukraine, the petitioners charge there's a military training school where the instruction is provided by former Israeli army officers and other instructors are trained by Israelis. The website has a photo of shooting practice with a Tavor rifle and notes the school trains units of the National Guard, whose members include Azov militiamen, as I mentioned, whose own website shows them using a Tavor. In May 2017, Ukraine's Prime Minister Vladimir Grossman visited Israel and met with Defense Minister Avigdor Lieberman to discuss the arming of Ukraine's military forces. In December of that year, a man claiming to be a former Israeli officer was interviewed by Ukrainian rebels, saying that he had taken part in battles in eastern Ukraine where he was instructing soldiers. All of this, concludes the Haaretz article, is unambiguous proof that Israel is exporting weapons to Ukraine, knowing that they reach right-wing militias, some members of which are avowed neo-Nazis who enjoy the support of the authorities, end quote. In several programs, beginning last December, I have brought you stories from the Israeli media describing U.S. collusion with Israel regarding Iran that have been totally censored by the U.S. media. Here's another one. On July 3rd, the Times of Israel reported that Israel and the U.S. have established a joint task force geared toward exploiting and amplifying internal pressure on the Iranian regime. Whether this is the same or a different task force as the one secretly set up between the country's two intelligence agencies last December, which I reported to you, and never reported elsewhere in the U.S. media, is not clear. The Times of Israel was citing a report in Israel's Channel 10 that Israel's national security advisor, Meir Ben-Shabat, and his American counterpart, John Bolton, had met to plan a strategy for turning up the heat on the government in Tehran. The Islamic Republic has seen multiple mass protests and the reported deaths of several demonstrators in the past week due to a water crisis and worsening economic conditions triggered by the U.S. pullout from the nuclear deal. The report quoted a senior Israeli official as saying the goal of the task force isn't to topple the regime. No one thinks that can be done, he is quoted as saying. Rather, he said, its aim is to exploit internal pressure in Iran in order to force the Ayatollahs, quote, to change their behavior, end quote. Bolton, who in past has called for both bombing Iran as well as regime change, said in May that toppling the government in Iran is not the Trump administration's goal. Seriously, does anyone believe that? Anyway, separately, Hadashah TV News in Israel reported Tuesday that the foreign ministry has sent a document to Israeli diplomatic missions around the world detailing efforts to turn up the heat on Iran. According to the government document, President Trump's exit from the nuclear deal and the American policy to create pressure on Iran correlate with Israel's policy. Well, Ed Schultz, the outspoken TV and radio host, died last Thursday. He was 64, and his outspokenness got him canned from MSNBC, as he explains in the short interview made at his last job as a host on RT America, the TV station subsidized by the Russian government that has a number of U.S. hosts, yet has been forced to register as a foreign agent by the federal government. It's instructive to hear what he has to say about the U.S. media and our political system. Here's Ed Schultz.
There was more oversight and more direction given to me on content at MSNBC than there ever has been here at RT. And I think that it's very sad that that story is not getting out. I think it's many times I was told what to lead with on MSNBC. Many times I was told what I was not going to do, and I've got a story that, had I not been involved in it, I would have never believed it. And Phil Griffin, who I consider a friend to this day, was a watchdog, far more than anything I'm exposed to here at RT America.
Did he tell you what to say? Did he tell you an angle to take?
Often. In fact, when Bernie Sanders was announcing that he was going to be a candidate for the nomination of the Democratic Party in Burlington, Vermont, I was the only cable host between Fox, MSNBC, and CNN that was there live to cover it. Now, there were live cameras there, but we had coordinated with the Sanders campaign that at 5 o'clock he was going to make his announcement, and we were going to cover this on the Ed Show. I go to Bernie Sanders' house that afternoon, an interview in the backyard, about a 15-minute interview. The grandkids are running around. It's a big day for the Sanders family. He's going to announce that he's running for president. We're going to carry it live later on in the day, and we're going to run this one-on-one tape with Bernie. 3,000 people are there on Lake Champlain. It's 5 minutes to air, and I get a phone call from Phil Griffin. You're not covering this. I said, Phil, Bernie Sanders is announcing he's running for president. He's going to be a president. I don't care. You're not covering this. And it got rather contentious. Now you're asking me for opinion. I'm giving you fact right now about what happened. And other people who were there with me will attest to the fact and back me up that this is what happened. We were told that we had to cover something that was totally meaningless. In another press conference in Baltimore, which was already had been in the news for a few days. We're covering Bernie Sanders live. We're coordinated with his campaign. And I'm told 5 minutes before, you're not covering Bernie Sanders. Now, let me give you the opinion. I think the Clintons were connected to Andy Lack, connected at the hip. I think that they didn't want anybody in their primetime or anywhere in their lineup supporting Bernie Sanders. I think that they were in the tank for Hillary Clinton, and I think it was managed, and 45 days later I was out at MSNBC. And when you see how the campaign unfolded, Donna Brazile feeding Hillary Clinton questions at the campaign, the DNC undercutting Bernie Sanders, the superdelegates that were organized by Hillary Clinton. I mean, in my state of Minnesota, where I'm a resident and pay taxes, Al Franken and Amy Klobuchar were superdelegates, and despite the fact that Bernie Sanders won Minnesota, they supported Clinton. It was the fix was in. The fix was in with the mainstream media. The fix was in with managing the news and shutting down Bernie Sanders. And it wasn't until he started matching the Clintons and raising money that he became, well, we gotta cover this guy. But from the start, the Clintons didn't want any competition. They didn't want Bernie Sanders around. They didn't want the Keystone XL pipeline. They didn't want to push her on that issue. They didn't want to push her on free education for all. And they certainly didn't want to push her on the TPP and also universal health care. Those were four main issues that Bernie Sanders, had he not been at the campaign, Hillary Clinton would have never had to address. And so I think the fix was in early on to deep six Bernie. To this day, it kind of pisses me off. Because they talk about collusion. There's nothing more than collusion than this.
And that was Ed Schultz, died last Thursday, 64, a rare voice in American media, taken off by MSNBC, and ended up being on RT. We'll miss him. This is Jeff Blankford. Thanks for listening.